This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last Thursday morning at Saxon Hill School in Jericho, four-year-olds played with kinetic sand and a group of three-year-olds were snuggled up with teachers and classroom volunteers listening to the book Chicka Chicka Boom Boom. After that, they all joined with their teacher in a song.
So I sing it and you sing it back. I said a boom, chicka boom.
I said a boom, chicka boom.
I said a boom, chicka boom. Oh, yeah.
These kids are enrolled in a state-approved preschool. Starting this fall, Vermont has required that preschool be available to every 3 to 5-year-old in the state. So right now, families are meeting with teachers and filling out enrollment forms. Many are also trying to figure out how they can make this work logistically. The state requires access to 10 hours of preschool per week. So if you're trying to figure out how to get your kid to and from an approved preschool and balancing that with other daycare needs, it can get pretty tricky. Critics say rural, low-income kids who arguably have the most need for this kind of programming are the least likely to be able to get it. We're going to take a look at the new law and how it's unfolding today on the program. I'm joined by Melissa Riegel-Garrett, a pre-K coordinator for the Vermont Agency of Education. Melissa, nice to have you on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, Jane. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Michelle Campbell, Director of Education at Saxon Hill School in Jericho. That is a preschool and full-day program for 3 to 5-year-olds. Michelle, what a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
Melissa Riegel-Garrett, set the table for us. Why is pre-kindergarten education something that the Agency of Education in the state of Vermont feels so strongly about that you want it to be and have made it to be universal, publicly funded access? What are the benefits?
I think what we really see are the benefits of pre-K for young kids. A lot of people talk about academic benefits, but what we are really recognizing is the underlying skills and attributes that children are really able to develop and get foundational exposure to in pre-K. So I'm talking about things like curiosity, problem-solving skills, capacity to communicate with others, a sense of self-confidence. These are all things that not only really lay the groundwork for children to be successful students in school, but really able to participate lifelong in our journey of life that's really a social environment. With all of that in mind, thinking about looking at the research that's out there on the benefits of pre-K, really showing that all children benefit from having some exposure to pre-K settings. I can remember when my child was 3 or 4 years old, really feeling like when we held a birthday party and had 5 or 6 of her friends over, I, as a parent, felt a little overwhelmed in my environment trying to support those kinds of interactions. So pre-K really enables children to participate in a social environment with their peers, with educated professionals that can support those interactions, the learning and development that happens, and knowing that the research really has borne out that, certainly children with needs see a lot of benefit from this. All children see benefits.
And it's something that's necessary for kids who are 3 and 4 and 5, not something that you can just start in kindergarten?
What research is showing us about the development of the young brain really is, between birth and age 5, the synapses of the brain are forming. And the more experiences children have that are intentional, developmentally supportive, really result in more brain synapses being formed that lay that foundation. So, I think if we were talking specifically about literacy skills or math skills, some of these academics, a lot of people, you could wait until kindergarten. But when you're really thinking about a lot of these social emotional pieces and kids having confidence, having curiosity, developing intrinsic motivation to learn, all of those pieces are really the way the brain develops. It happens between birth and age 5.
Michelle Campbell, what does actual curriculum look like for you and for your school, Saxon Hill School in Jericho? We heard some of the kids playing, and they'd been playing with kinetic sand and singing songs. And, you know, that's something that you can do in a lot of home settings or home daycare settings. So what makes for you a qualified preschool curriculum?
Play. Definitely lots and lots of opportunities for young children to play. I think that one of the things that we do, and we do really well, is recognizing that children are very capable, that they're scientists, they're curious, and that the way they learn is by exploring their environment, by exploring the woods, by exploring ponds, by really doing hands-on work. So those are the opportunities that we support children in doing. I think that many children can get this at home, but there are many children that cannot. So the opportunity to be able to come into an environment where teachers are very intentional in their observation of children and thinking about ways to extend children's curiosities, to set the environment up so that it enriches discovery is a key.
Are there sort of set curriculum standards as well? Excuse me, I'm thinking of things like, you know your days of the week, know your alphabet. I mean, are there things that are sort of standard that you'd look at as maybe more academic in a way?
I'm thinking no, definitely not. That's for kindergarten. Hopefully, although I will say kindergarten is changing a bit. The whole idea is that children come in and that we look at them as being capable, that we really help them develop emotionally and socially, that we offer them lots of opportunities to express themselves in a variety of different ways, be it verbally, be it art by painting or sculpting with clay or, you know, creating sculptures like our kids did yesterday in our sculpture garden, which is basically pieces of wood and stone.
And that interaction with their peers, is that Melissa was talking about how important that is in terms of having that social interaction and those skills developing. Is that something that you work on as well?
We think about partnering and negotiating and cooperating. And children have a lot of those skills. And if we just guide them a bit, and how to solve problems that maybe we could say, I want to turn, or are you done with this? Some kids really need a lot of that coaching, a lot of that mentoring, and I think that's something that we can do and do well.
Parents of young kids, are you following the changes to Vermont's laws about universal preschool? And if you have your kid enrolled at a daycare that's now considered a preschool, you might be getting a hefty discount on your annual charges, but a lot of daycares aren't preschools. So what do you do if you're a working parent trying to give your kid the best head start but struggling to balance that 10 hours a week of preschool at an approved school while also dealing with your own schedule and perhaps another daycare? As I said, it can get tricky. We'd love to know what you are experiencing and maybe what questions you have as well. 1-800-639-2211. That's our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Melissa Riegel-Garrett, Act 166, this universal pre-K bill, was passed in 2014, and it goes into full implementation this summer in anticipation of the 2016-2017 school year. But it sounds like most school districts in the state had already started implementing the law, and there are only a few who are left. So how many school districts are still working on this?
Well, what we know is approximately a quarter of the schools, school districts that have kindergarten programs. So remember, we do have some school districts that are high school-only districts. So the ones that actually are operating kindergarten programs, about a quarter of them went forward with early implementation last year. So we're looking at the remainder of about 75% of them that will be moving forward with full implementation this year. That doesn't necessarily mean they weren't doing pre-K last year. Remember, we had Act 62 that remains in effect until June 30th of this year. So many of those districts that were not early implementers of Act 166 were still operating under the rules of Act 62.
So what are the challenges, though, that these districts that are now facing full implementation are facing? I mean, if it were super easy, I suppose they all would have just done it. So what are the challenges?
I think probably the the big pieces, the shift that requires schools to offer it. So for schools that previously were not implementing Act 62, pre-K's new programming for them, and they're thinking about, given the law and the rules under Act 166, if it makes sense to operate school-based classrooms, to try to help families access this through partnerships with the community-based pre-qualified programs or a hybrid of the two. For schools that are transitioning from Act 62 to Act 166, I think probably one of the larger challenges is really thinking about it in terms of the number of children now that will be seeking and wanting access to pre-K. Under Act 62, schools had a choice about whether or not they wanted to partner with community-based programs, how many of those they wanted to partner with, where they were located, and now, all families in their district who want it really can access pre-K for their child. So it's a bit of a capacity issue.
Because one of the ways that this works is that it's not necessarily in a public school setting that all of these qualified preschools are. So you may have qualified preschools, as I understand it, that can be in a home daycare setting. They can be in a center-based daycare setting. They can be in a public school. So, Michelle Campbell, can you give us a little bit of the landscape there and how you see it working out for different ways of people being able to access this pre-K education for their kids around the state?
Well, for us, we were Act 62 partners and have been an Act 166 partner presently. And we had an opportunity to not have our lease renewed this past year. So,
because you had an independent building.
We were renting in an independent space. And so we were very lucky that the Chittenden East School District offered us space in two of their buildings, and we chose one because it seemed to fit our needs the most. And so we're renting two classrooms in a public school, and we have created our own nest, so to speak. As when you form any partnership with anybody, any new partnership, there are certain fears. Some of our families didn't return because they were worried that we were moving into a public school and that it was a big place. They didn't want their children going there. There were some families we had to move further out. So there was that transportation issue for some of our families that were from Williston or on the other side of Essex Junction. But we got through that. We moved. And actually, I think we're better than ever. We have a great partnership with the UID. Folks, they have been
UID
there.
Being Underhill.
Underhill Independent District within the Chittenden East School District, which is in Jericho, even though it's called Underhill. Welcome to Vermont. And it's a small school. They had four classrooms. We are renting two of them. So in other words, we are able to offer to our families two programs at the same time, which we weren't able to do before. So over the summer, we moved, and we're in this fabulous space. We brought our own playground. We brought our own fencing, and we've established a new school, so to speak, based on our same philosophy. So it's worked out well for us. I see the struggle for families in finding that pre-approved program and having to get either their teacher or child care provider licensed or having a mentor. That I think that is a struggle. There are some financial aspects, too, that folks are coming. But when you form anything, when you do anything new, you have to look at it as an opportunity. You have to look at it the way we look at children. It's problem solving. It's constantly, being flexible, negotiating, trying on different things, seeing what works.
And in terms of that flexibility for your programs, do you have some kids who are just coming for the 10 hours a week? I understand you offer full day programming.
We do not offer full day programming. We've always only been half day. But we have this year, based on parental input, we have something called extended discovery. So we have increased the hours that kids can be at school. Our longest or shortest program is 10 and a half hours a week. So families are paying that half hour more. We have been very creative. We've been established since 1964. So a fourth of our budget comes from fundraising. Our families are very active. Plus, we have formed a partnership with an apple orchard, so we give tours, so we bring in money that way. And then we offer summer camp, so we bring in money that way. So it's constantly thinking on your feet. It's trying out some new and different things to make it work for everybody. I think the beauty of this program, though, is the support that it offers to families and to all children.
Melissa Regal-Garrett, let's talk about that that issue, though, of timing and flexibility for parents. You know, one of the challenges or critiques here is that more affluent parents or parents in more urban settings with the potential for more choice in childcare might, A, they might already be getting a quality education for their toddlers, their 3 and 4 year olds, but that parents who are less affluent, less able to afford a childcare setting that has those qualified teachers and curriculum, or parents who have fewer choices because of the location where they live or their job schedules, or any number of reasons may still effectively be shut out from this kind of program. I'll give you a common scenario. You're a parent who works full time. Your child is in a home daycare setting that's not a qualified preschool. You'd like your little one to get those 10 hours a week at a qualified pre-K school. And you could do it maybe at your local public school in your district, which has expanded to include pre-K education. But it's a couple of half days a week and you work full time and you don't have the ability to get your child to and from the school. So are parents like that really closed off from this opportunity, even though it's publicly funded and universal access?
So what we're actually seeing in response to that in true Vermont form are really local solutions and local decision-making around that. So we've seen some pretty cool partnerships that are happening with public schools that may provide transportation to providers that are already on their bus routes anyway. We've also seen where providers may, if they're within walking distance, walk to the public school and drop kids off and pick kids up. And, you know, any number of other scenarios. It's also possible that, you know, a program like the Saxon Hill School that offers a 10 and a half hour a week program that's a community-based program also may have the ability to partner with other non-pre-qualified providers that are nearby, again, in some of the similar solutions and scenarios. Sometimes it's been a family that's willing to provide carpooling. So right now, a lot of local solutions are evolving. The law does ask that it charges the regional Building Bright Futures Councils to work with schools and with families to really look at pre-K capacity. And by capacity, I don't just mean number of slots. I also mean by what is that type of capacity. So what are parents seeking for scheduling and that kind of thing, and to really try to figure out on a local level how do we meet the needs of particular families. The other piece that we've really built in, and I can't take credit for it, but Act 166 is co-administered by the Agency of Human Services as well as the Agency of Education. We have a very vibrant implementation team that meets biweekly with members from both agencies as well as a private member that comes and shares that perspective. But, you know, the data team at the Agency of Education has really worked hard to develop an evaluation plan that we presented to the legislature this year. And in that plan, really some ability to collect data on some of these scenarios that you mentioned. And with that data and really knowing who's able to access, you know, what families aren't able to access, where are families accessing? Are they accessing on the local level? Are they accessing nearer within a trajectory nearer to where they work? A lot of these questions that we have, we've had a team that's really been able to develop an evaluation plan that will help answer some of those questions. You know, we had Act 62. Act 166 is an evolution from Act 62 in many ways. And now we're going to be able to learn a lot from this law, but we need the opportunity to go ahead and implement. I do believe Act 166 is going to offer more children in Vermont the opportunity to participate in pre-K than we had under the scenario of Act 62. I also believe that we're going to learn a lot from the data from this evaluation that's going to enable us to make data-driven decisions about how do we make this better, you know, if we need to.
We're talking today about universal access to pre-K education, and coming up, we're going to get more input from parents and families who are experiencing some of this, who have questions or thoughts to share with us. If you are among them, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. How's this working for you in practice? Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Melissa Regal-Garrett, pre-K coordinator for the Vermont Agency of Education, and Michelle Campbell, director of education at Saxon Hill School in Jericho, a preschool and day program for 3 to 5-year-olds. We're looking at the state's universal preschool law, which goes into effect statewide for the next school year. Many families are in an enrollment period now, and if you have a question about how all of this works, or if you'd like to share your own experience, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Lee, who's calling in from Reading. Hi, Lee. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling to talk about some of our school has had a preschool for approximately 4 years, and we've encountered a few difficulties, you know, and really offering it to all of the parents in our town for a couple of reasons. One, the main reason being that it's, you know, a partial daycare, not daycare, I mean, it's a partial preschool. You only go a few hours a week, and a lot of parents can't access it because we're not allowed or permitted to offer any sort of after-school programming. And I was just wondering if that was going to be addressed in future, you know, versions of this program. I know that our school has gone through the process of becoming accredited through the daycare program. That's what we did as we became a preschool. But it seems like there's some sort of disconnect because parents, even when willing to pay for after-school care, are not permitted to do so. We're really not allowed to run a after-school program for our pre-K kids. Thank you.
Lee, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing from you. Melissa Regal-Garrett, maybe you can explain that because, you know, in many cases, there are daycares that are running full-day programs and a portion of the tuition is now coming from districts, well, through parents. But so Lee's saying, you know, they're not allowed to have this sort of aftercare program. Can you explain the differences and what might change?
Sure. So not knowing a lot of the specifics of that particular school, you know, one of the unique features of Vermont education system is that it is, in fact, locally controlled. I'm not sure I can really address their particular scenario. The pre-K, the 10 hours of pre-K, is, in fact, considered, you know, its own portion of any program. And I know that there are schools in Vermont that are offering full school day programming. I'm also aware of schools that are marrying some aftercare scenarios with their full day or their part day pre-K programming. And often we see that in a situation like Michelle was describing at Saxon Hill, where an outside private provider is actually invited to come in and provide that you know, extended day scenario option for children.
But Melissa, as you mentioned, you know, the fact that this is sort of locally run, and you were talking about some great initiatives that communities are starting up that involve either parents working together in terms of carpooling or, you know, providing sort of walking transport between a school and a daycare setting that might be available in the afternoon. That is still all dependent on, you know, on people living in a place where that's happening or being able to participate in that or able to engineer it themselves. So, I mean, I presume there are some parents who are finding this completely unavailable to them because of logistics, because they either can't get there or they don't have a way to get their kid to and from a preschool to a daycare setting, and they work full time and don't have flexible jobs. So, I mean, it sounds like because it is so locally done and individually run, there may still be families who are shut out from this.
Yeah, and like I said, the law really, you know, does point to the Regional Building Bright Futures Councils as a forum to be where some of these conversations can actually, you know, happen, where some of the problem solving can be done. I would also say, you know, we've done a lot to try to connect the pre-K coordinators that are housed in public schools or in supervisory unions. To each other, to try to learn from each other what some of these models and scenarios look like. So there really are a lot of efforts being done to try to support these conversations in happening. But it's, you know, the programming that happens at public schools in Vermont, this is the way with local control decision-making happens on a very local level for all grade levels, not just pre-K, and that includes after-school care for all grade levels. You know, that's a conversation that can happen at, you know, within that school board. And so, you know, really have been encouraging families, you know, to talk to the school district personnel. They are, in fact, interfacing with pre-K teachers and pre-K coordinators in their schools in order to actually enroll. So, you know, it's an opportunity for relationship building between families and folks that are helping to support the rollout of Act 166 at the local level. And then there are folks like Michelle who also, you know, providers of pre-K and pre-qualified programs, as well as folks that are working in child care programs that are not pre-qualified now, are also great supports for families in terms of helping them be advocates for the services that they would like to see developed and the kinds of programming that they would like available to them.
We got a couple of comments that are on sort of opposite sides of the coin here, but Melissa says, our experience is that most private centers have simply raised their tuition rates by $3,000 per year. This has been really disappointing and I believe violates the spirit of the law. So, you know, from that perspective, parents not actually seeing a tuition discount in qualified pre-K settings, but actually just seeing the centers raise their rates. Jessica comments from sort of the other side of that, but asks, how is it affordable for child care centers if all of the pre-K money is supposed to go to the parents, but we need to hire a licensed teacher? Many children are in child care for 40 hours beyond the 10 hours of preschool, so do programs just change their rates? Michelle Campbell, maybe you can comment from your perspective here at the Saxon Hill School and what you're seeing, and then, you know, we can expand to sort of the statewide look.
I can tell you that our rates didn't change other than, you know, cost of living or whatever. I think that part of the issue is folks have not been budgeting everything. What happens and has happened, I think, historically in early education is the folks that work there are nurturers, and lots of them have made some exceptions for families that are struggling. A lot of staff members have purchased things out of their own budget, and I think they have done detrimental to our occupation. And now I think that folks see that people are being supported financially, are starting to think about what does it really cost? And so budgets are starting to reflect that. I don't think that they're raising it $3,000. I think that there are, and I'm not going to speak for, because I don't really know what they're doing, but my guess is that people are finally saying, oh boy, what does it really cost to take care of young children, be it as part of schooling or being a part of childcare? What is the real cost? And I think that's what we're seeing. That's the crux of the problem right there. I think we have our school is run by parents, so we have a really good – our parents have a really good idea of what it really cost and really value it. So I don't think we went through that, but I certainly hear from my colleagues that same kind of thing. And I think that that's something that we in the state of Vermont and probably in the United States in particular have to really come to understand. Do we really value young children, and what does it really cost to take care of them and provide for them and educate them?
But Melissa, I can see it from the parents' perspective of thinking, this is going to be really wonderful for me because I suddenly have this $3,000 tuition that I can apply to my child's care during the day. Or I guess for the 2016-2017 school year, it's $3,092. And that's supposed to accommodate the 10 hours a week for 35 weeks of the year. But if you are a parent whose program suddenly says, well, actually, our tuition rate for the daycare for the following year is going to be $3,000 higher, you've sort of lost what appeared to be a state universal, you know, public education grant, basically, for your child. So how are you seeing it, Melissa?
So what we're actually seeing is a transition from what some of the practices were under Act 62 to what this looks like under Act 166. So with Act 62, each school district negotiated with each provider of pre-K on a one-to-one negotiation basis, and they arrived at what the value of that pre-K slot was, and in some cases it was, you know, as low as $500. In others, it was actually higher than the now statewide rate of $3,000 per child, $3,092 in the next school year. And so it was just an amount that varied depending on what school district you your child was a resident of, and then what program you actually attended. And with that, it arrived to the program almost in a block grant scenario. So there wasn't a ton of transparency for families to know, you know, what the value of that was. Under Act 166, it does arrive as a tuition payment. And what that's really creating in the scenario for programs is the need to actually do true cost budgeting. So taking a look at what are the expenses to provide, you know, this level of high quality care. So they need to be 4 or 5 stars in our quality rating and improvement system. And in order to do that, there are ongoing expenses. Most notable is, you know, requirement of hours of professional development every year. In addition to keeping up the environment in a high quality way. But they also need to employ a licensed teacher, and that's someone that's got an endorsement from the Agency of Education in Early Childhood Education or Early Childhood Special Education, and the salary and benefits cost to attracting that teacher and then also to retaining that teacher, keeping that teacher there and employed there for consistency for kids. You know, there's a cost to that. So building a budget that reflects those costs in an accurate way that then produces a tuition bill that's reflective of that, tied directly to that. You know, yes, we are, because instead of this money coming in sort of in a block grant kind of scenario that allows tuition rates to stay low, it comes in as a direct payment on a tuition invoice. So, yes, we've seen tuitions go up across the state. But what we've also seen is that tuitions, for the most part, are not going up by exactly $3,000, or we don't anticipate seeing tuitions going up by exactly $3,092 next year.
So we just have a couple seconds left.
More of a balanced scenario. Tuitions go up, but families see the benefit of that tuition payment. So they're out of pocket, and what they're paying is less. There was a Chittenden County study done on
Melissa, we're running out of time for this, and I just want to make sure I get one more question in from
sure.
Kristen, who just wants to make sure she can find out what her community offers for pre-K. So before we let you go, how do people find out? How do parents find out?
Sure. There's actually a website on the Agency of Education, the Act 166 website. And if you scroll down a little ways, there's a link to a list of pre-qualified providers. And you click on that, and it allows you to search by town. It allows you to sort either by public pre-K options or by private community-based options. And it brings up a portfolio of those programs so you can see hours and days of the week that they offer services, and it gives you all their contact information.
Perfect. And Michelle Campbell is also reminding me you can also go to your school district website and find out information.
Absolutely.
There.
Look under pre-K.
Michelle Campbell is Director of Education at Saxon Hill School in Jericho. Melissa Regal-Garrett is Pre-K Coordinator for the Vermont Agency of Education. We'll keep following this, see how it's going later on in the school year and maybe after a full year of implementation. Thanks, Michelle and Melissa, to both of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Jane.
Coming up, Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger has announced his pick to be the next head of the Community and Economic Development Office for the city. It's the state's current Housing and Community Development Commissioner, Noelle McKay. We'll talk with the nominee about the housing affordability crunch in Burlington next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Anyone who's tried to rent an apartment in Burlington knows that the rental market is tight. And if you're trying to get something that's a step above student housing but still within a moderate budget, well, good luck. It can be really tough. Burlington has some housing challenges. And if she's confirmed, it will be Noelle McKay's job to address those challenges and many other for the Queen City. Right now, McKay leads Vermont's Department of Housing and Community Development, but the commissioner has just been named by Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger to be the next head of CEDO, the city's Community and Economic Development Office. Noelle McKay joins us now to talk about her vision for Burlington's economic picture. Noelle, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
What do you see as the most important thing you'd like to tackle if you're confirmed to head up CEDO?
Well, I think you named one of them, which is the housing challenge that they have. But I don't think it's just a challenge. I think it's a great opportunity. And there's a lot of different pieces coming together, a lot of great partnerships. And I think that's the best kind of challenge and opportunity that the city has, along with the technology companies that are coming in, and also how do we make sure that children in the Queen City really have a strong start across the board?
You know, housing seems like an intractable issue in Burlington, or at least one that has plagued several administrations and spread out over many years. Do you have a fix? Are you going to come in and just, you know, snap your fingers and fix it?
I wish I could, but there's a lot of great things happening. And I think there's the spectrum. So recently, the point-in-time count for homelessness, we've seen a decrease in Chittenden County and across the state, which is really good news. And that has happened because there's a lot of people focused on the issue. And the mayor and the city have really been focused on that and have worked with a lot of partners for the warming shelter. We've also seen COTS, Champlain Housing Trust, the University UVM Medical Center, Chittenden County, United Way have all worked together to look at temporary as well as permanent housing, which is really important to decrease and make sure that everyone has a home. And then when you look at the next kind of the affordability issue, the other good news on that front is we have seen a very modest up in the vacancy rate. I think they've gone from 1% to 2%. We really want it between 3% and 5%, and there's a lot of projects on the horizon in Burlington.
Well, how do you – I mean, there are a lot of projects on the horizon, but it's also – it's a difficult place to build. I mean, it has an old housing stock, and you have to be able to work within the confines of Act 250 and other building constraints. So how do you sort of ease that pressure over time, not just in the sort of affordable housing for people who are transitioning from homelessness to permanent housing, but for people who are making a moderate income or, you know, couples who are trying to live in the city that they work in?
Well, I also want to remind you that in terms of Act 250, the state administration, legislators, and many others have worked for to make it easier and faster and more streamlined in terms of Act 250 and state permitting in our downtowns. So that's a really plus, and we've worked on that very hard over the last several years. I think the other thing is that you have developers that are committed to doing smart growth development, working in town, reaching out to the community members. And while it might take a little bit longer, like we've heard about the town center project, you're getting a better project because there is community input, community understanding of those projects, and hopefully that over time will increase the number of housing stock.
Burlington has an inclusionary zoning, and they're committed to making sure that whatever's built has a certain affordability range in it. And also Champlain Housing Trust, which really was formed from CETO during when Bernie Sanders was mayor, also is an incredible leader in perpetual affordability for the city. And working and tying all of those pieces together is going to be really important in my new role, I think.
Is that part of why you think you've been tapped for this job? You have a lot of expertise in housing issues, in zoning issues, in anti-sprawl work, and in looking at how communities can build the kind of community they want and how buildings are sort of incorporated into that.
I think that's part of it. I think the other part of the skill set I bring is I really believe in community and partnership building. No one group, no one entity can tackle these problems alone. And if I had a silver bullet, I could make a lot of money on this, but I don't. And so it's really about a private public sector coming together to understand the issues and really move them forward. And I know, you know, the other issue that we need to think about in the city is, you know, different demographics and making sure that we don't gentrify certain parts of the town and leave people behind, because that's really important consideration. And so CETO also has a very active social justice and environmental justice section, and that's going to be important for me to understand their work and make sure we can incorporate it across the board in the work that the city's doing.
I'm talking with Noelle McKay. She was just nominated to be the director of CETO, the Community and Economic Development Office in Burlington. And on that question, Commissioner McKay, on the idea of how do you include all of the city's diverse constituents and different demographics in economic opportunity, what is your approach to that?
I think the thing that you need to do is work with the people that are working with different segments of the population. So whether it's the groups and the organizations that work with the new immigrants, or if it's the folks that work with, like, the folks at COT and those that work with those that are homelessness and different needs, those the students coming in, and Champlain College is a perfect example of really creating great innovative students who we want to stay. And so how do we integrate that and make sure there's a workflow? But it's about reaching out to the partners that are working with different populations, because that's where the trust is going to be. If I come in, people don't know me, they might not feel comfortable. So it's finding those right partnerships that can really be honest and tell you what people are struggling with, what are the issues in different parts of Burlington, and understanding what those kind of micro community needs are.
You know, there have been some questions raised, even just since this nomination became public, about whether or not you should be granted a waiver from the residency requires that come along with this job.
Yes.
You live in Shelburne. The job requires you to live in Burlington. The mayor would like to see you get a hardship waiver, but that's running up against some frustration or complaints from some city residents who think that you should have, you know, what they call skin in the game here and live in Burlington. What do you think about that, and what will you do if you're not granted a waiver?
I did live in Burlington for most of my time here in Vermont. I started on Crombie Street, and then I rented there for a while, and then I moved and bought a condo in Red Rocks. And if I was looking for a house, I would absolutely look in Burlington. We bought a house about 3 years ago and looked for about 6 months to find housing. We wanted to be in Burlington. It just wasn't something that fit our budget, and so we moved out and put a lot of money into a home in Shelburne, and it would be a real financial loss for us. And I totally understand why the people in Burlington would want the CETO director to live in Burlington. The thing that I've heard is no one wants something done to them that aren't living there. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've said is I'm not doing anything. I follow the rules, whether it's the federal programs or the state programs that we oversee, that CETA will oversee, and also what the mayor's office through the city council is really enacting. So I don't have a, you know, an office or a place that I can just really make decisions that aren't publicly vetted. And so that's going to be, I think that's an important consideration. And if I'm not, then we'll really have to weigh if I could take this position.
So you might decline it if you
are
required
to move. Yeah, unfortunately. It's an incredible opportunity, and I think my skill set could offer something to the city. But I understand if that's what the city council feels is important, I understand that.
Noelle McKay is Commissioner of Housing and Community Development for the state of Vermont. She's been nominated by Burlington Mayor Murrow Weinberger to lead the city's Community and Economic Development Office, or CEDO. Thank you so much for talking with us, Noelle. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane. Always a pleasure.
And that does it for today's show. An increasingly common way for Vermonters to get a pet is by adopting a rescue dog brought up from so-called high-kill shelters in southern states. It seems like a win-win, saving dogs from certain death and getting a beloved family pet in the process. But there can be risks. Disease, severe behavioral issues that haven't been identified or disclosed in the pets, and a lack of vetting of potential owners. We'll talk about it tomorrow on the program, and you can send your experiences or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our show is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen. Today's show was produced by our intern, Anna St. Marie. Today is her last day with the program. We will miss you, Anna. Thanks for all your hard work and dedication, and good luck. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.